Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. You know what I'm about to say, but please hear me out. The Tortoise Shack relies entirely on you to pay it forward and keep it free for everyone. The couple of quid you throw us carves out that bit of space we need to be able to continue to have conversations like the one you're about to listen to. It's really simple. All you got to do is click the link that's at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. It says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Have a look around and see if there's a level that suits your budget. It's not a one-way street. You get a ton of additional content, including podcasts in the last couple of days with Fred Logue on the government's planning and development bill, which has generously been described as anti-democratic, and that's saying something. There's also a great chat with our friend and co-host of Shrapnel, Sam McElwain, that's there right now. And Rory sat down with economist Kieran Nugent to talk about the generation inequality wealth gap, and no doubt is contributing to large parts of the friction in our society. And that's just the last 36 hours. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I'm shutting up now. Enjoy the show.
Hello everyone and welcome to Palcast, a podcast brought to you by Yusuf Al-Jamal here in Istanbul, Helena Coben in Washington, D.C., and Tony Groves from Dublin. Today is March 19 and it's 5 p.m. here in Istanbul. And today we have a very special guest joining us from Dublin. Chris Andrews is a Sinn Féin TD and a spokesperson for sports. He's famously known for taking off his jacket to reveal a Palestinian football jersey when Joe Biden was addressing the Irish Parliament. Very glad to have you, Chris.
Thanks, Yusuf and Helena and Tony. It's, you know, I suppose it's always interesting discussions to have around Palestine, what's happening in Gaza. I suppose I have had the pleasure and the honour of working in the Gaza Strip it's about 10 years ago now. And I worked in a place called the Palestinian Centre for Human Rights. And with Raji Sarani, who was the head there. I lived there for about 5 or 6 months and went fishing, and if you can call it that. And, you know, and I played football, had Al Hilal Football Club, and played football there, and played, you know, just seven aside because I was a bit past my peak in footballing terms. But although some would say I never peaked in football, but I've great memories of the Gaza Strip. I have, it's like, you know, it's just transformative. Time I spent in the Gaza Strip and meeting with friends and I still keep in touch with them. And then subsequent to that, we had the Gaza Kids to Ireland, where the Gaza Kids came over from the Gaza Strip, Al Hilal Football Club. And we used to, and they played various matches against teams around the country here. And it was real. And again, some of those we're still in touch, close contact with many of them. And, you know, so I suppose I am spokesperson for Sinn Féin on sport. But I have an added affinity with football in the Gaza Strip. Because I remember when the El Clásico nights were on between Barcelona and Real Madrid, it was always a great event because all the shisha shops were jammed. The kids were going around with they get their Ronaldo haircuts and they were all going around looking the business. And it was an event every evening there was it. And it was usually midweek, but when there was an El Clásico. So I have fantastic footballing memories, sporting memories, and friends made true. And when I was going over on one of the flotillas, I brought over some Shamrock Rovers football gear. And we that was part of the flotilla, one of the flotillas I was on. And we brought Shamrock Rovers, who and Shamrock Rovers are a League of Ireland football club, top Ireland's number one football club, League of Ireland football club. So, you know, I've had, you know, a great affinity with people in the, you know, families and in the Gaza Strip, and I've great memories there. So, I just find it like devastating. I have to say devastating to see what's happening in the Gaza Strip. And you see the destruction, the terror, the horror. And I know from having spent time there that Palestinians just want to get on with education, get on with life, get on with going down to the beach, you know, and playing football on the beach. And again, the back here boys were bombed, slaughtered when they were playing football on the beach. But that's what Palestinians, in my experience, want to do. They just want to get on with life and live life and love and play football and sport. And then you see, contrast that with the hate and the horror that Israel is imposing on Palestinians. And it's
thank you, Chris, for sharing these memories. You know, you brought almost a decade when I used to watch these games and Barcelona and Real Madrid, and many people in Gaza follow the Spanish league for some reason. But I just hope that those Palestinian boys that you brought from Gaza were able to beat the Irish boys on the playground eventually. Could you please share with us how you feel today? You know, you have many memories. You said you went to Gaza's seaport and you went fishing there. And you have a lot of memories. You watched football. You spoke to people. You lived there for a few months. How do you feel like seeing, you know, all these playgrounds, all these lives, the seafront completely destroyed?
Look, it's like I say, it's hard to put into words the devastation that it has had on people right across the globe. And I'm no different from people, the absolute horror that people watch, and just the sadness as well. And I went out, like you say, went from the port in Gaza City, and you didn't go too far out. I think 2 or 3 kilometres was the furthest we could go out. So we were going up and down the coast. And actually, I wouldn't be very good on a boat, and I got really badly sick. I was just sitting there in a heap for like 24 hours. And they called me the White Shaheed, the White Martyr. Because I was like, I was green for the whole. I was absolutely no use to them. That's for sure.
Well, you were green because you're Irish, isn't that how it goes?
Yeah,
Saint Patrick.
Green, between the gills, Chris. Green gills.
Yeah, so very much.
Actually, Chris, I'd love to hear a little bit about your work with Raji Sarani, who is one of my heroes too, like working with the Palestine Center for Human Rights. You know, if you have a couple of memories from that.
Well, I suppose what I was doing there was around encouraging people to engage in politics. I was working with different schools and different community groups, but I was working with the staff in the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And it was around, I suppose, because I have a political background, and it was about trying to give what we do here and see if any of it was applicable in the Gaza Strip for getting people to be interested and engaged in politics, and how important it was to. And Raji Sarani was like so supportive. He was here in Dublin a few months ago, and it's always lovely to catch up with him. But you know, the whole event is just like, it's honestly, I don't have the words to be able to, you know, convey what the emotion that it stirs up in me anyway. And I know a lot of other people are the same, and it's really horrific. And like I say, families there, they just want to get on and educate themselves and live life and just love and get on with things and enjoy their sport or whatever. And
Chris, can I come in for a moment and just say you've been Yusuf mentioned you wore the jersey when Joe Biden arrived in the Dáil and you took your jacket off. It wasn't universally greeted with a lot of support at the time, was it?
No. It's funny, isn't it? It's like that. The whole mood was that don't upset Joe. And when I look in hindsight now, when I look back, I wish I had been a lot more assertive and a lot more outspoken. But at the time, even doing that seemed to be like going against the grain, because it was like being not being nice, a good host. And the Irish, as after Paddy's weekend, in fairness, we are good hosts and we entertain people. But there was a sense within the Dáil that that my actions were not in keeping with being a good host. The only thing I regret now is that I wasn't more vocal on it and more assertive in my, you know, I simply wore the shirt. I wasn't rude or I didn't heckle or anything like that. And in hindsight now, I wish I did. But look, you know,
so
you live and learn.
Chris, when was that visit by Joe Biden? I'm forgetting when it was. I know he made a big deal of it, and here in Washington D.C., he was all Irish solidarity. Was that before October 7th or after October 7th?
Oh, it was well before. I think it was early on in the year. I think Tony might have a better.
Right. So
I'm not sure, but it was a good.
It was a good while ago. It's almost a year ago now, I think.
Oh, is it nearly a year? Yeah. But I have to say, in terms of sports and we recently got 67 members of parliament. So there's about 160 something, 165 TDs, and then there's senators and all that. So we got a number of 67 TDs, MPs and senators to sign a letter calling for FIFA and UEFA to ban Israel from international football and ban their domestic teams from playing in European competitions, UEFA competitions. And I suppose it was great to get 67 members of parliament. But equally, I have to say, it was disappointing that we could only get 67. Because when you think about it, there's like another 100 and whatever members of the Oireachtas who don't see, like what you'd have to ask yourself, what has Israel to do for people to say Israel needs to be isolated in every element of life in terms of sport in particular? That's obviously my brief. So like what does Israel have to do before people will say we shouldn't be playing sport with this team, this nation that is just like inhuman
Chris, can I ask it? Can I ask the obvious question on this? Just though, was when it comes to Russia, we see the Olympics are taking place in Paris in the next few months, and we see there's still calls for Russia to be excluded on the back of the war in Ukraine, and yet there's not the same solidarity when it comes to Israel and what they're doing to Palestine.
Well, look, it highlights the double standards. I actually heard I heard on the news bulletin just there when I'm in the car now, and I just heard one of the FIFA representatives saying that the Israeli FA or Olympics Committee had not breached its own charter. Now, I don't know how that makes any difference. Honestly, it's about power and it's about money, and the victors write the history, and that's what's happening. They're rewriting history and rewriting, you know, how, like, it's just inexplicable. Now, honestly, I get so frustrated, but look, I think it's really important that we keep the pressure on, that we keep advocating small little wins. We have there's a new group, and you might look it up when you get after this podcast is recorded, but Irish Sport for Palestine. And so it's been really successful. So Irish Sport for Palestine is a group of sports people in Ireland, Irish sports people who have signed a letter calling, I think, over 300 people, sports people, elite sports people. Now, it's not sports people like myself who goes around for a kick around. We're talking like footballers, Gaelic footballers. So Irish Sport for Palestine are really progressive. They're really active. And like I say, they've harnessed a lot of David Hickey, who would have been a Dublin footballing legend back in the 70s under All-Ireland winning champions. Michael Darren McCauley has 6 or 7 All-Ireland medals. You have Joe Brolly. You have loads of rugby. Tony Ward, who is actually a very interesting character. He's from a Jewish family, and he has been active in campaigning against the genocide. And so Irish Sport for Palestine is really positive. It's getting a lot of traction. And in fact, recently, Scottish Sport for Palestine has been set up using a similar template. And hopefully that will be successful as well.
I love that idea, Chris. I think it's great. You know, maybe we could do something. I know here in the United States, there are all kind of like there's writers and there's celebrities, but getting sports people involved would be fabulous. You know, during the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, that the actions of like boycotting South African teams, I think it was really important for the white South Africans because it made them feel excluded. Do you have any kind of idea of the impact of your actions on Jewish Israelis and whether, you know, they feel excluded and that makes them want to change the government's policy or not yet?
Not yet, to be honest with you, Lena. I really don't. It's very hard, I suppose. Yeah, so Irish Sport for Palestine also has a couple of people who, and you mentioned apartheid, South Africa. We have a number of people who actually travelled, went to South Africa to play at the time, and they have forever since regretted it. And they now are saying that, I suppose they know better than anyone, the need for a boycott. And they've been very outspoken here in Ireland. Mickey Quinn as well, one of those who travelled to South Africa, much to his everlasting regret that he did. But like I said, he's learned from it and he's been a strong supporter of a boycott of and ending the genocide, boycott of Israel and Israeli sports teams and ending the genocide. So, you know, it's small steps, but they're steps in the right direction, I think.
Thank you, Chris, for sharing this with us. A few days ago, Mohammed Barakat, who's a member of the Palestinian National Beach soccer team, was killed. He was bombed in his family's home in Rafah. And just before that, he shared a message on social media. And I think it's available. The translation is there, subtitle, English subtitle, in which he said, probably these will be my last words. Do you have any words for, you know, people who liked him and loved him and his family back in Gaza?
Well, just to extend my solidarity with his family and his friends and his community, because I know that in Ireland we have a real bond between us and Palestinian and sports people. Irish people love sport, and I know he loves sport. Obviously, being an elite player himself, so it's just I suppose that we're thinking of him and his family, and the sooner we get justice and peace, and we can't have peace without justice. And so justice is the most important and peace will follow. And I think that we just have to keep going and fighting for that justice.
Thank you very much for joining us. Meanwhile, in Gaza, the Americans are building a new seaport very close to the road that Israel has been building in the middle part of the Gaza Strip. It's very strange because there is already a seaport to the north of Gaza, Gaza's seaport. It was partially destroyed by Israel. And we know very well that the idea of a seaport is Netanyahu's idea, and he has presented this idea to the Americans early in the genocide. And for some reasons, the Americans have waited for a few months before starting to build a seaport in Gaza. I really do not see the point of building a seaport when there is one, or airdropping aid that falls on the heads of Palestinians and kills them. While we have thousands of aid trucks stuck on the Egyptian side of the border, Israel doesn't allow Egypt to send these trucks to Gaza, and the need is huge. We've seen recently, and we're going to talk more about this, we've seen how Israeli forces have assassinated Faiq al-Mabhouh, who is the head of the Civic Operations Department in the Palestinian police. He's been in charge of organizing aid convoys that got into the north of Gaza for the first time after 5 months, where every single family got 4 kilograms of flour. So he was in charge of that. And once his plan and coordination worked out, Israel went broke into a Shifa hospital where he was and killed him.
Yeah, and he really had a good distribution mechanism. And that is the problem now. I mean, they can deliver maybe some barges full of food to the new seaport or whatever, but then getting it to the families that need it, that is the real problem. And, you know, that's where you have the chaos. That's where you have the Israelis, you know, bombing and shooting and using tanks against gatherings of families who are desperate for the food. I mean, the stories that are coming out are terrible. And it's been quite clear from day one of this that the Israelis are entirely prepared and eager to use vital humanitarian supplies as a major way of putting pressure on the people of Gaza. And obviously that is completely against international law. So it's just more of the same, I guess, and really, really depressing to think of all of our friends, especially your friends, Yusuf, who are there, especially in the north of Gaza.
And, you know, after breaking into a Shifa hospital, they forced Palestinians who sheltered there to move further south, to the south of Gaza. So the Israeli plan of depopulating at least the north of Gaza hasn't stopped. They're doing it slowly now by breaking into specific neighborhoods, sending special forces, turning the lives of Palestinians there into literal hell by, you know, shelling them and bombing them. And all of a sudden you have all these special forces attacking people and killing them and destroying their houses. Sometimes they destroy entire neighborhoods when they break into these neighborhoods and areas, kill people and push whoever they could capture to go to the south of Gaza. So this is important to mention to the listeners and to give context into Israel's plans.
They're also telling you
depopulating.
They're also telling people who they've. So, for example, I know of one young man who went to check on an apartment. They arrested him and decided to use that as leverage to make his family move as well. They said, if you want to see your husband again, effectively, you must move towards Rafah. And only there will we, you know, talk about releasing him for the crime of simply wanting to check if the apartment was still standing. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that's going on. That's ethnic cleansing. That's forced displacement. That's all of those things. And Helena, just world seems to just shrug its shoulders still.
Yeah, I have a little bit of good news from the London Book Fair.
Please.
It seems hard
we
to...
We need some good news.
Yeah. So in the book world, there are two big international book fairs every year. There's one in Frankfurt in October that I used to go to when I was doing more active publishing. And then there's one in London in March every year. So at Frankfurt... There was last October, it was outrageous what happened because a Palestinian writer called Adania Shibley was supposed to receive a prize, and the German government and the German, whatever the association is, the Publishers Association that runs the book fair, said that they couldn't do it at the book fair. And there were all kinds of other actions taken against Palestinian voices. And, you know, these book fairs are where writers and publishers and movie producers and like the cultural elite gather to do business. So it's really important from the point of view of the global culture. You know, people coming from all around the world, really important. So at London, the great news was that there's an organization called PEN, P-E-N, which is a very like venerable and respected writers organization. So there are a number of different PENs, and you will hear about PEN USA, which has just, you know, taken some outrageous steps against Palestinian voices here in the United States. But there's also PEN England, and then there's PEN International, which is based in London and has some wonderful people running it, some of whom I had the honor of meeting. So they had two seminars at the book fair, one of which was about threats to Palestinians' freedom of speech, and the other of which was just to celebrate Palestinian voices. So it was good to see that kind of support from PEN International, which is a very important, you know, gathering of intellectuals and writers from around the world. And they've just actually released their annual report, global report on, you know, all the writers everywhere around the world who are under threat. It contains a list of 13 Palestinian writers who have been deliberately killed in Gaza, amongst them our friend Refat Al-Arir. And they even, with our permission, used the poem that Rifat had written back in 2011 when he talked about, if I must die, you must live. So, you know, it was good to feel that degree of support from the kind of the people running the book fair and from PEN International, and also from a lot of interest in our Gaza books from publishers in Brazil, in Mexico, in Spain, and from all around the world. So I've just been busy kind of trying to follow up on all that. But I think, you know, all these cultural things that are going on, whether you're talking about writers or you're talking about, you know, what Chris was sharing with us about sports, it's really important. And but it takes too long, you know. Meantime, we need the ceasefire. And that's my main thing. Just what can we do to get a ceasefire and end the Israeli occupation of Gaza?
One thing we can't do is trust on the Irish politicians to go to the White House and actually demand a ceasefire or I don't want to be patronizing about our own, because obviously Ireland has been outspoken. They have said stuff, but the rhetoric certainly softened as we got closer to the bowl of shamrock and the journey to the White House to hand it over to Joe Biden. And unfortunately, there was a phrase, and I think it will, after our Taoiseach Leo Varadkar leaves office, it will be a sentence I'll associate with him now for a long time, is that he said he thought Joe Biden's heart was in the right place. And I think that will leave a stain on his legacy, because that clearly you can't say that in a clear conscience and watch what's happened over the last 164 days and say his heart is in the right place, when, you know, if his heart was in the right place, he would have called for a ceasefire or demanded a ceasefire, enforced a ceasefire a lot quicker, because he has got that power. So it's disappointing. So I want to just say that on the record. But sorry, Yusuf, go ahead.
I just hope that he had the time to talk about Zach's case with Biden, because I remember a reporter in Post asked him if he's going to bring it up, and he said if I have the time.
I don't think he did, as far as I'm aware, you know. And I spoke to Zach recently, and he's still in Rafah.
Just let's remind listeners who Zach is.
Zach Kanaya is a Irish Palestinian man whose family were allowed leave through the Rafah crossing, but Zach's name was taken off the evacuation list, and he remains there now. And we're at the stage now whereby it's been raised, you know, with our Department of Foreign Affairs. It's been raised in Ramallah. And effectively, in many ways, we should be calling it what it is. He's been illegally detained by the Israeli state, and that's what's happening. If it was another, you know, I have freedom of movement. I can go to the airport now and go where I want. My Irish passport opens up the world to me. Zach has got those rights, but he's not able to. If you can't attest the right, you don't have them. And more has to be made of the fact that that's the reality of this. And his wife Batul was on the telly the other evening, calling on the government to do more. And unfortunately, we're still in this situation. So yeah, it's very disappointing. And the big fella is missing his family. He's missing his family a lot. So he'd probably listen to this and give out to me, but he was a bit down when I was speaking to him, you know?
Yeah, he has every right to be, you know, to feel down. You know, he feels being failed by his own government. And it's not a joke. He's literally living under Israel's bombs that, you know, doesn't distinguish between, you know, anyone that killing children and women and elders. I would like to thank you, Helena and Tony, for today's conversation, our great partners from Just Word Educational and the Echo Chamber podcast. Looking forward to more discussions and debates over the next few weeks. I would like also to thank our sponsors, the Hashim Sani Center for Palestine Studies at the University of Malaya in Malaysia. Thank you very much. And have a wonderful day.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of clothes and some strings, make it white with a long tail, so that a child for me.